Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackanddrea.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We are spending this portion of WGTD's morning show hearing about the very intriguing story of Saida Hafiz. She is someone who is enjoying a very happy and successful life, but her life began in most unpromising circumstances. She grew up in a home that was plagued by domestic violence, substance abuse, at times poverty, and it is extraordinary that she managed to rise above those unpromising beginnings, but it is a past that she was not necessarily completely free from, and it has been a difficult journey for her to find wholeness and wellness and healing. She is now working as a yoga teacher and wellness expert, and approaches life from a very holistic point of view. And it is through this approach that she has really found herself centered and happy and most fulfilled. She makes her home now in the San Francisco area and is a holistic health educator in the San Francisco Unified School District. And her book about her life experience is called The Healing, One Woman's Journey from Poverty to Inner Riches. It's published by Parallax Press. And Saida Hafiz, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you for having me, Greg. This is really excited. I'm glad to be here.
I'm happy to be able to speak with you. I think what is really interesting about your book, among many things, is that often when somebody has, in a sense, found what seems to them to be kind of the key that unlocks greater happiness for themselves, for their life, that often that is this great moment. This is this wonderful thing. It did this for me, and I think it should probably do it for you as well, and here's how it works. Your story is actually much more complex than that. It is a story of rising above and out of some unhappiness and finding some of these keys, and then in a sense having those keys, in a sense, fail you, or those keys sort of fall from your hands a little bit, and there is a time where you fall back into some real despair before kind of finding your way again. So it's kind of a turbulent journey that you have taken. I wonder if you could just say a word about what it was like to relive that and what it was like to write about that with the honesty and openness with which you do. I commend you for that, but I think some people in writing their own life story might choose to write it in a way that's not quite so unvarnished and open.
Yes, you know, when selecting the title of the book, The Healing, the reason why it resonated with me is because it's an ongoing process. You can heal from something, but then there are different layers. So my life had like onion layers, and I really had to peel back different layers within my life to really get to the root of the suffering. And a lot of times we are really good at managing the symptoms of something, but can you go deep enough to get to the root and the root cause? And the thing with life, you don't know what that layer underneath is really going to be like. So what I have done is trusted in 2 tools, the practice and application of yoga postures, hatha yoga, and whole foods. So when basically dealing with what I would call getting things back to its simplest form, like how do I move and take care of my body? How do I nourish it? And when I got to experience sort of the power and the beauty of food and yoga working together, then I was able to face quite a few of these demons that were being revealed in my life.
Hmm.
And which was, yeah, I wanted things to be quite simple in the sense of, or maybe easy is a better word. You know, graduated from college, got a decent corporate job, and I'm going to be home free. But coming from the circumstances in which I came, there was more to the story. It was, now you're in this new situation with corporate job and all of that, but now it's time to actually heal the wounds that have been kind of numb and ignored for so long.
Right.
And that was, that was an eye-opener for me.
Sure.
The next journey of my life.
When you describe what it was like to grow up in the household that you did, racked with domestic violence, you write, "Our house never felt like a home. Instead, it felt more like a refugee camp, with each person trying to survive after a 25-year bloody civil war." Describe to our listeners a little further just what this home was like, and in a sense, the kind of scars that it left on you and your siblings.
I think that when you're in a home of domestic violence, sometimes I feel that the adults may think it's just between the two of them. And when there is, you know, a punch being thrown, I don't know if the adults understand how deep that vibrates throughout the house, the family, and outside of the walls of the house. And so much comes with that. A lot of times, I think as a kid, you know, we felt shame that this was going on in our family and embarrassed. And then we try to just forget it or maybe make light of it. And that was just really, that's really hard for a lot of us to absorb, particularly as kids, because, you know, with holistic health and eating styles, what I've come to understand is that our experiences resonate throughout our cells in our body, and our cells react to that violence. And for me, it was sort of this contracted feeling. And I also believe that for my family members, my siblings, they had this really tight feeling of trying to protect themselves. So again, like when there's yelling or a punch being thrown, you retract, you try to run for cover. And in doing so, you're kind of holding in that pain. And what I found with my sibling was that their way of trying to be normal or release the pain was to seek out the opposite, which was something that would make them feel expansive, like drugs and alcohol. And for me, it was lots of sugar. And so just to try to feel normal. But, you know, you get into this situation where you're just trying to run for cover. And so I feel that within the home, nobody was able to really relax or bond in a way that was healthy because of the energy that was going on in the house. Even when my dad wasn't there, there's always sort of this feeling on edge where I didn't even feel like my home was my home. I felt that I always felt like sort of this intruder, or I'm just trying to, you know, stay there until I can get out. And it's a strange feeling for a child to feel. And it was kind of interesting when I got into practicing the yoga and eating well, that my body started to get to this centering point of what it meant to feel healthy in the body, to not feel so afraid. But it was a journey. It doesn't just happen overnight. It takes practice to kind of unwind the negative and difficult situations that we all had to live through.
Right. And I find it interesting that in the midst of engaging in some of these new activities, as you found yourself kind of in this as a young professional, doing some of these things that you just kind of thought was maybe part of what young professionals do, you probably entered something like yoga or some of these cooking classes thinking that this was one way to distance yourself still further from this unhappy childhood. And in fact, it seemed to while these activities obviously gave you great benefit, they also, in a strange way, opened you up to this. I mean, you began to experience flashbacks that were very vivid that took you back into all of this unhappiness earlier in your life. What do you think was going
on
there?
Right. Well, what I know was going on was that because I had consumed so much sugar growing up, and finally I did this three-day detox where my cooking teacher had instructed us to, you know, eat everything from scratch as much as we could and to not have foods with sugar added and refined foods and refined sugar. And so I thought, oh, you know, her thing was like, if you eat this way, you'll be healthy. So I decided to try this for 3 days. I don't even know if I was trying to say, okay, I'm going to do this for 3 days. I thought, okay, I want to start feeling better and eating this way. And so by the third day, I started to have what people would call withdrawal symptoms. And so now sugar is being researched where it affects the liver very similarly to alcohol. So you can get fatty liver disease by consuming too much sugar the same way you can with consuming alcohol. And it's just a different degree. And so when I was eating more whole foods and not eating sugar, I was having these flashbacks in the same way that an alcoholic may feel when he or she is not drinking. You know, when you decide that you're going to go cold turkey, and that's what I realized I had done. I didn't realize that this was a radical move. Then whatever I was covering up, I started having these flashbacks, these PTSD experiences, just as the same way as an addict would. When you take away that thing that's numbing you or covering over, you start to see things a little more clearly. And that's the moment of power for us where we can then decide, okay, how do I want to move forward? And it's a pretty enlightening moment. But again, it's for me, it was this sort of trajectory of, okay, how do I now process and integrate this new information? And so it had me actually confront some folks in my family. And, you know, I guess the same way that would happen when someone, you know, is overindulged in drugs or alcohol, when they start to come down to get back to sort of more clarity, there's sometimes this confrontation of like, okay, what really happened to us here?
And maybe one way to phrase that, as you do in your book, is to say, my new holistic health lifestyle demanded that I become more of who I really am, not just good, but authentic. This was a means of becoming your most authentic self, which is probably not even what you had in mind as when you first engaged in some of this. It became kind of a surprising benefit.
Yeah, and Greg, I really thought that I would get this corporate job, date successful men, and go on vacations and read magazines. Like, I really thought that that was what the good life was. But instead, you know, I, again, like I said, faced with more of my past and my truth. And in that first scenario that I had given you around, you know, being in this corporate lifestyle, I, in my mind, had this thing of, I just want to continue being the good girl. Because my mom had really kind of received all of this strife, which affected the whole family, I didn't want to cause her any extra problems. So I just wanted to just have this life that was successful, that she could be proud of, and, you know, and sometimes parents can brag about their kids. And what I realized was that this was also a way for her to feel like she was a good parent. And so I bought into that. But when I realized, or like I said, came more and more faced with really who I was and really what I had to do to be a good person, if, you know, in air quotes, it really was be an authentic person. What does it mean to come from what I've come from? How do I integrate those experiences and make them meaningful into my life? Where can I go from here? And with that, I realized that I had to be other than good. I had to truly be myself, because it was taking too much work to not be myself. Whenever you're trying to live up to someone else's expectations of who you are, particularly if they don't know who you truly are and what you desire and what you're cultivating, then that's really, really hard work. And so what I realized was that my true nature was beneficial in and of itself, and that it could be a contributing person to society and to the family. I didn't have to be someone else's idea of what they thought I should be. And that took work throughout my life to come to that deep understanding of being grounded into really who it is I am, and what that then means to other people. And not everybody initially likes you going against that grain.
Of course. So you write about the breakthroughs, the insights, and then moments in your life when you fell back into some despair. You give up this nice corporate job in a bank and try to begin starting your own business, and fall into some frustrations and difficulties and so on. And I, again, appreciate so much how honest you are about the setbacks and the dips along the way, that this is not a smooth road. I really appreciated how at one point you talk about, at one point when you are staying with a friend and trying to sort of regroup and regather yourself, you found that one of the things that was very helpful to you was watching Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood on PBS. You wrote, I had watched it as a kid, but this was different. I loved the simplicity of it and the care he showed toward the children. I loved the land of make-believe, the trolley, and that whistle. When I was watching Mr. Rogers, I felt like I was being reparented properly. Such an interesting turn of phrase, and I think a lot of us wouldn't stop to think about the enormous difference that something like that could make in the life of someone with these kind of struggles and hurts.
Yeah, you know, Mr. Rod, and I love that the documentary is out, and I still have yet to see it. I'm going to go hopefully this week. There was something, and there still is, in, again, sort of that true nature of what the Mr. Rogers show and Mr. Rogers himself puts out there. And it's such a real and powerful way to connect to oneself. And I feel that we can watch it at any age as a reminder of, you know, just being who you are. And that was his huge message of, you know, I like you the way you are. And that openness of that basic acceptance is huge, I think, for lots of people, where you're not considered strange or weird. You're just accepted for who you are. And my watching those shows in some of my lowest moments in life, to me was just an an awesome reminder of having value, that I have value, that the work I can do here on earth is important, and that, and it's my work, you know, whether anyone else judges it as important or not important, it's who I am as a person, and that has to have value.
Hmm.
And so I just really, yeah, thank you for reading that passage. I really feel that it's super powerful.
Absolutely. And of course, your book explores many of the details of the lifestyle that you now have adopted, and the way in which both yoga and the macrobiotic diet have made an enormous difference in your own well-being and fulfillment and happiness. I wanted to be able to, before our time is gone, I wanted to be sure to give you a chance to expand on something quite fascinating in the book. When you talk about the concept of yin and yang that you learned mm-hmm. about in exploration of yoga. And I've heard that term before, but when I read about it in your book, I realized that I really didn't understand anything about it at all, about, in fact, mm-hmm. what those terms really mean. You talk about them, in fact, referring to expansive and contractive energies, and then you were able to kind of apply that to the reality of the family in which you grew up and how there was yin and yang there. Could you just say a word about that? I found this especially fascinating and insightful.
Yeah, so yin is the expansive energy, and yang is the contractive energy. And there are activities that we do that make us feel tight or contracted, and it could be working too much. And then there are things on the other side that can make us feel expansive, like drugs, alcohol, sugar. And I know for myself, what I was doing, I was eating in the center to feel more centered without these swings. And I find that what's really important is that food can make you feel in a particular way. Like each individual food has an energetic quality to move you closer to center or away from center. And that's why, you know, when you have a meal, there's a delicate balance of things that can center you. And the yoga that I was practicing, or that I am practicing, the Hatha yoga, often is a very expansive. It makes you feel for lack of a better word, flexible or open. And the life that I had come from was very contractive. So there was a way where the yoga allowed me some peace without taking me far into not being able to control or not feeling in balance with myself. Like drugs and alcohol and sugar often help you feel spaced out or out of balance. That's too expansive. But you want expansive things that make you feel closer to your center. So if you go out for a nice run, which can be a very contracting exercise, then you want to add some stretching or some openness or some meditation to kind of have you back to center. And I hope that is giving sort of a better experience of it. One of the things that I had talked about in these two veins is that, so for instance, I'm not promoting drinking at all, but like a margarita with the salt rim is a very, the salt is, very tight and contracted. And then the alcohol is expansive. So a lot of times when we've worked hard or want to relax, we like those swings. And so that's why I feel people really love, a margarita drink. But really, the way that I was using the food and the yoga was to create sort of this balance of helping myself to heal from a family that was just so tight, and where I had to, where things felt just rigid or like you're always walking on eggshells. And so when I was getting into the yoga and the meditation, it really did open me up to experience life in a more full, centered way. And so that's how I was able to understand that. And any activity any situation, any conversation can be put on this chart. You can have conversations that make you feel tight and uncomfortable, or you can have them conversations that make you feel centered, or you can have conversations that make you just feel too spacey. So anything that we do within this, within our lives, from food to activities, to conversations, can all be placed on this chart. Is it pulling you one way or another?
Hmm.
I hope that makes sense.
It does. And of course, as I said, your book goes on to explore many other facets of what your own journey has been over the years. It's a book that I assume took a number of years to write, and it certainly it took quite a number of years for you to live all of these various experiences, but I'm glad you've shared this book with the public. Again, it's called The Healing, One Woman's Journey from Poverty to Inner Riches, published by Parallax Press. Saida Hafiz, the author, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. It was terrific to speak with you about your fascinating book. Best wishes.
Thank you, Greg. This was great. I really appreciate you having me here today.
The time is 8:36. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part 2 from the Morning Show archives coming up in just a moment. For the next few minutes here on WGTD, I am so pleased to be able to speak with author Chris Ballard, who actually is someone who has written extensively for Sports Illustrated magazine, for a number of other publications, the author of Hoops Nation, a wonderful a book from several years back, the author now of a very intriguing book called The Butterfly Hunter, Adventures of People Who Found Their True Calling Way Off the Beaten Track. The book is published by Broadway Books. And in it, Chris Ballard speaks with a number of different people who work in vocations that we might not even imagine exist or work in ways that just might be intriguing for all kinds of different reasons. It is a wonderful book. It really gives us a lot to think about. And Chris Ballard, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you.
One of the things that you mentioned at some point is that you yourself, over the course of your life, have had more than a few oddball jobs and have experienced a few moments in your life when you kind of wondered what it is to feel a calling to one's work. Tell us just a little bit about that and how that maybe helped you in the writing of this book.
Yeah, I think I was one of those kids who growing up, I never quite latched onto the idea of, you know, choosing your major early, or I didn't have some flash of vision when I was 13 years old and I'm going to be a carpenter, a lawyer, and so I was sort of drawn to these different jobs, and so I worked at Yellowstone National Park for a while, and I was a ping pong instructor briefly. But the supply exceeded the demand in that case, and I took a job bartending and did some traveling around the world funded by freelance writing. And so I didn't feel like anything was really latching on to me, and I'd sort of dabble in one thing or another. But I was really interested in the little worlds that I would go into, each of these subcultures. I also was a door-to-door vacuum salesman, which is an anecdote I recount in the book, and that sort of taught me I wasn't good at sales. I only sold 2 vacuums, and 1 was to my parents, which was very kind of them. But each of these little worlds I'd go into, I was always amazed, like, wow, this is, from the outside, I might have thought this was, a job that one might think was weird or laugh at or sort of trivial, but inside each of these things, there are artisans of the door-to-door vacuum salesman's world.
Hmm. You ended up at some point finding yourself intrigued by the idea of talking to people who really loved their work And you also were interested beyond that in trying to learn lessons from people who were really good at some of these interesting jobs, as though the excellence of others could be a lesson for the rest of us. That's kind of an interesting idea.
Yeah, and that was, I guess, the how I came up with the premise was this feeling of, okay, you know, I, especially in my generation, in my mid-30s, you grow up and it was this expectation that, okay, not only are you supposed to have a good job and know what it is early, you're supposed to be good at that job, you're supposed to love that job, and ergo that job is going to make you happy. And this is, it's not even a goal sometimes, it's an expectation I think we have. And so, you know, it's just like, okay, find your calling and you'll be happy. But I just was looking around me, and you know, a lot of my friends are—they're still trying to figure out what they want to do with their life, and you know, they're asking a lot of the same questions. And so, it occurred to me that in some of these experiences, either when I was writing profiles for the New York Times Magazine, I would often pick people who were really good, unusual stuff, or in my own job experience, that the people who are in these sort of, you know, you could say sort of fringe jobs, but these jobs you would never just stumble into. You know, you wouldn't. Guidance counselor wouldn't tell you to do one of these jobs, that people who are really good at them seem to have this passion that was you know, above and beyond what you would normally expect, probably because they have to. You know, if you're going to be a mushroom hunter like one of the guys in the book, you know, you're not going to get a lot of people who, when you tell them what you do, are going to know what you do or are going to give you sort of societal the credence to that. You know, there's not the associations there are with a doctor or a lawyer or something like that. So you have to really be invested in it yourself. And that's what led me off on this search to find people like this, the idea being, you know, I hoped, or my theory being that if you were really good at something and it was something very unusual and you were passionate about it, that would probably be the, you know, the closest manifestation of this, you know, the idea of a calling in today's, you know, very secularized society.
Mm-hmm. You know, as someone who I actually juggle three jobs, all of which I love, and most of the time, I would do all three of the jobs for free. I mean, if such a thing were, in fact, sometimes I feel like I should be paying somebody else, I mean, for the enjoyment that I derive from what I do. But in your book, you remind us that such a notion farther back in history was all but unknown, that for much of our history, work has been regarded as a burdensome, demeaning necessity in life, not necessarily something from which people would derive meaning. That's something I hadn't stopped to consider before, that now we live in a world where it's possible to think about our work in those kind of terms.
Yeah, it was sort of interesting going back and looking at the attitudes, because I mean, in the time of the Greeks and Romans, the greatest ideal was to not work at all and be engaged in enlightenment, you know, and making the best of your mind, and that, you know, the closest word the Greeks had to it translated as pain, and in the Latin it meant sorrow. And so it wasn't until you had Martin Luther coming along, and he sort of gave it this religious valuation of work as a calling, and then that eventually became you know, sort of built upon by Benjamin Franklin, the idea that for the American colonists, okay, not only were you honoring God by doing this work, but you were honoring God by making lots of money. And this was sort of this, you know, a very American idea that, okay, not only was your work a sort of this holy duty, but it was your duty to make a lot of money. And so that's sort of on through the years has become this idea of a calling where, you know, by the 1900s, we had, the 1909 was the first guidance counselor in the United States, and that was this idea of, okay, not only am I working as a calling and am I working to make money, but now I'm working to be happy. And that was sort of a sea change there where, you know, especially in the U.S., our economy was at the point where some people could afford to have that decision. Okay, I'm not just going to do what my dad did. I'm not just going to do the job that I can get or that my class system allows me to get. I'm going to do what I want to do. And now we've taken that, of course, to the extreme of, you know, you type in, you know, how do I find my dream job on Google, and you'll get, you know, millions of results, and everyone's espousing like the seven-step way to get your dream job, and I thought that was interesting because the idea of a dream job intrinsically is different for every person. I mean, my
right.
dream job is, you know, just by definition is probably different than almost anyone else's because I have different likes and dislikes. So the idea that anything is considered a, quote, dream job, that struck me as a little bit false.
Well, you end up exploring the stories of 10 different people, 10 very different jobs, and each one of them, as you say, it's kind of like its own little world, mm-hmm. and each one sort of carries with it its own sort of lessons. One of them that I thought was particularly interesting was Don LaFontaine, who is a voiceover person and a very, very successful one, but someone who's all but invisible, even though he's in the middle of the entertainment world. But that's such an intriguing thing to think about, of being part of something really exciting, albeit in a somewhat sort of anonymous way. Kind of gives us a different view of what it means to be special.
Yeah, and Don, obviously, for those who haven't picked up the book, he's sort of, they call him, quote, the voice of God, and he's the sort of the birther of these trailers that you see in movie theaters, you know, where you have someone say, in a world before time, in a land before law, and he's got that great deep voice, and he's been doing this for 40 years, and he's done over 3,500 trailers, and so much so that the industry, everyone else you hear tries to sound like Don LaFontaine now, and he records these out of his house in Los Angeles, using a DSL line, and they'll call in a script, and Don will, you know, put on his headphones, and he'll do one take, and, you know, maybe he's talking about a new movie or a new TV show, and he'll say, take it bigger, Don, and say, okay, it takes it a little bigger, and, a little slower at the end, a little slower at the end, and then boom, in, you know, 5 minutes, he's done, and he's made a chunk of money, and he's on to the next one. And so, like you said, one of the things that was interesting to me was this idea of this guy is famous. You would know his voice in an instant. When he first called me, I was, you know, I played the voicemail for my friends and for my girlfriend, who's now my wife. I was just so excited because here's this guy and he's on my phone. And so you have this voice that's so famous, but he himself is rather anonymous. No one recognizes him. He doesn't look like what you'd expect him to look. He's, you know, rather small man, and so he's sort of, you know, he's not recognized for his craft to the extent that someone would ever recognize him. And also, you know, he's basically talking emphatically for a living, so it's not considered an art by most people. So he's sort of in that, you know, that middle gray area of, like, how do I justify what it is I do? It makes me fabulously wealthy. I'm the best at the world in it. But, you know, some people might say, okay, you just read lines for TV shows. And so one of the things he said to me was, he said, Chris, you know, I think this is sort of silly. But I could tell, you know, there was sort of I didn't really quite believe him because you couldn't do something that well for that many years and really think it was silly.
Right.
Yeah, and by the end, I think one of the things is he saw it as, okay, and this is one of the things he said to me, Chris, is there's one person out there who really wants to see this movie, maybe a bad, you know, reality TV program on Fox that I might think is bad, but there's someone out there who really wants to see this, and I'm speaking to that person, and I'm making their life better if they see this show. and in that way, he said, okay, you know, I'm helping people, and I have this gift, this voice, and I'm giving it to them.
You mentioned him kind of being in kind of a gray area. It reminds me of a Richard Florida quote from the introduction to your book. I've interviewed Richard Florida before.
Oh, really?
About his book, The Rise of the Creative Class. But you quote him saying, "Everything interesting happens at the margins,"
yeah.
and Mr. LaFontaine would be one very good example of that. A real inspiring story is that of Doug Blevins, who is someone who, at first glance, we could never imagine being out on a football field, really in any capacity, and yet there he has been, earning an amazing amount of success coaching place kickers.
Yeah, Doug, I think of just pure inspirational stories. And the book is a mix because I wasn't going to try to find people specifically whose stories would inspire other people. I just wanted to find interesting stories and figure people could take from them different things. But definitely Doug was the one who in the end, it, you know, you want to go try to run a marathon or something when you're done talking to this guy. He born with cerebral palsy, never walked, but from the time he was a kid, has just been absolutely devoted to the idea that he was going to be an NFL kicking coach. Actually, originally just said he wanted to be in the NFL as a coach of some sort. So he latched onto the idea at a young age that he needed a niche in the NFL if he was going to get there. So he chose place kicking, you know, field goal kicking and punting, and he started writing away to NFL coaches. He would watch tape. He would volunteer for high school teams, junior college, anyone who would take him, and he'd go around in his wheelchair, you know, shagging the football, doing whatever it was, and just soaking it up. And as with anything, if you are really devoted to it and you spend a lot of time, and that time is not wasted like I have to work from 8 to 5 today, it's like I want to go voluntarily follow around these place kickers, he became very well versed in this. To the point where people started asking him to do one-on-one coaching for their high school kid who they hoped could play in college, something like that. And from there, ended up getting an assistant coach at a college position and on until he ended up working for the Miami Dolphins, the New York Jets. He worked with Adam Vinatieri, who's obviously kicked the game winners for the Patriots and Super Bowl. And the guy is now one of two or three best kicking coaches in the world. And just his feeling about this is that, you know, everyone always told him what to do, but he wasn't going to listen to it. Because in his mind, the only thing that could make him happy was to be a coach, and it had to be in the NFL. And so he figured, okay, even if that maybe isn't that plausible, that's what is going to give my life meaning, so I'm going to try to do that, and if I fail, well, then I fail.
Hmm. You know, I appreciated the story you tell right at the top of that chapter where, as we can well imagine, someone from Hollywood approaches Doug Blevins with the idea that let's make a TV movie of the week about your inspirational life, and he had little interest in it. I mean, if such a film would be made, he would want that film to be about football and about the craft of place kicking and the kind of work which he does. And of course, your typical blue suit from Hollywood just wouldn't see that. But one hopes that someday this story maybe can be shared in a way that does justice to the work that he does and why he loves the work so much.
Yeah, that's, as you say, that's his response was to curse them out, basically, because he felt like, okay, if you want to make a movie about, you know, me crying myself to sleep and overcoming the odds and sort of that Disneyfied idea, you're diminishing the fact that I'm very good at this skill, and that he thinks that is what's interesting. And, you know, if he starts allowing himself to say, okay, I'm good for a guy with cerebral palsy, then he feels like, that's the first step to me not succeeding. If I ever allow myself to think, okay, I'm succeeding despite this handicap, which, by the way, he calls the Cadillac of handicaps, and he tries to, in every possible way, pretend it doesn't exist. One of the things that happened when I was with him is he almost instigated a bar fight from his wheelchair. and he's like, Chris, are you going to have my back? And I was like, Doug, what are we doing? You know, but he just goes through saying, okay, if I ignore that I have this to the best of my ability, then I'm not going to dwell on it or, you know, self-pity. So the idea of the defining TV movie about him being Doug Blevins crying himself to sleep, he was really pissed off about that idea.
Understandably so.
Yeah.
We have just a couple of minutes left, but we need to touch on the 10th and final story in your book. It's sort of the title track of the album, so to speak, where you do speak to a butterfly hunter, someone who, when you first contacted him, lived and worked right up the road from us in Milwaukee, and literally a butterfly hunter who's encountered all kinds of creepy crawlies along the way. What a fascinating life for him.
Yeah, Phil DeVries, and this guy, he's just in tune with the natural world and with himself. And, you know, when I first contacted him, he'd been off in this long, as he called it, steep, in the jungle. He's an entomologist, and he spent probably two-thirds of his waking hours the last 30 years in one jungle or another chasing butterflies. And he doesn't collect them like people who collect them and put pins through them. He feels that's wrong and gauche and all these other moral reasons, but he classifies them and he uses them for biodiversity studies, and he will set traps and measure how many butterflies come through an area in a certain time and then release them, etc. But he has just grown up and he is just loves bugs. And so if I was talking with him and we were eating dinner, he might bolt up in the middle of dinner, run across the restaurant if he saw an interesting bug on the wall and check it out, and he'd start explaining, look at this, look at the way, you know. And
I like you say, to dine with DeVries on a warm summer night on a back porch when the air is thick with fireflies and moths and uncountable other flying creatures is to die alone. Dine alone, yes. You know, it's interesting, though, as we learn about him and all these other fascinating people and the work they love so much, and especially his story in some ways, do you ever wonder about any of these people maybe being what we call workaholics and maybe deriving too much meaning or too much pleasure from their work? Or by and large, didn't you see too much of that?
It's interesting. One of the guys in Chapter 4, John Narek, who's this model train guru, that's a definitely a question I touched on with him, and that, you know, what I ended up feeling is I tried to put together in Chapter 1 a list of some of the sort of field observations, like what themes could I draw from these people, these unusual lives, what could I pull together? And one of the things I noticed is that this is the idea I sensed among them, that you sort of have to figure out what balance of work, what balance works for you. And each person has a different combination. I mean, La Fontaine, for example, was his most unhappy he ever was at a point when he was at his career apex. He was making a lot of money. He was early 80s, and he was really hitting. But he's working his long hours, and his marriage had fallen apart. And for him, the work alone wasn't enough. And so in that case, you know, you could call him a workaholic at the time, and it was a negative thing. And he's now created a balance, and he sounds like he's much happier, and the work alone couldn't do it. But then for some of these other people, that ratio is much higher. Maybe it can be 80% work and 20% for the rest of your life, and that made them happy. You know, it seemed like as long as each person figured out what it was worked for them, they had to have that self-awareness of, okay, I can't just work all the time and ignore my family. That's not going to work for me. Or with Phil DeVries, the butterfly hunter, he married another entomologist. So when they talk about bugs. And that was his way of saying, okay, I have this overriding, you know, just passion for my work. So I'm going to marry someone who has the same passion. Ergo, I will be able to have this, you know, family relationship, but it's still going to revolve around bugs. And in his case, also jazz music. That's his second love. So that was interesting to me to find, okay, there isn't like, okay, I need to set aside this amount of time for my family. Maybe not necessarily so for some of these people, as long as they found a way to do it.
Interesting. There's so much that's interesting in this book. It's again called The Butterfly Hunter, Adventures of People Who Found Their True Calling Way Off the Beaten Path. Published by Broadway Books, the author, Chris Ballard. Chris Ballard, I really enjoyed the book, and I'm glad we could talk about it today on the morning show. Best wishes to you.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Tomorrow on the morning show, the monthly visit of Nan Calvert, and with Nan on tomorrow's program, Matthew Collins, who is the director of Kenosha County Parks. There's lots we can talk with him about, but we will speak primarily with him about the Pike River Restoration Project. By the way, my guest for Friday's morning show, Melinda Maynor Lowry, the author of The Lumbee Indians and American Struggle. I was to record our interview this morning. Unfortunately, Melinda Maynor Lowry lives directly in the path of Hurricane Florence and was forced to evacuate her home. So our interview was postponed. So we will be having to find a different interview for Friday's morning show. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackandDrea.com. Support also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers available at carthage.edu/admission/transfer. This is WGTDHD Kenosha Racine.